so you can kill my body. But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Welcome to Economics and Beyond. I'm Rob Johnson, president of the Institute for New Economic Thinking.
Say you can kill my body.
Say you can kill my body.
But you know you can't mess with my mind.
Say, no, you can't kill my mind.
You know we'll go away.
We're gonna go away.
Come back, come back, come back,
come back.
My second time.
I'm here today with Chakrat Chakrabarty, who is the president of New Consensus. Previously, he was the campaign manager and then the chief of staff for New York Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, also known as AOC. Chakrat has been crafting with his colleagues a set of proposals or visions of how the Biden administration, newly elected, and the Electoral College has now affirmed, and how they can transform this country, get us to a place that is what I might call healing and moving beyond the frustrations and despair that led to the election of Donald Trump. Chakrat, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
This is such a turbulent year. We've had this presidential election, the pandemic, all kinds of financial bailout, anxiety, this and that. And I think everybody's looking forward to 12 midnight on December 31st so we can turn the clock. But I'm curious what you're seeing. And I'm looking backwards before we look forward. What have you seen this year? What are you seeing now amidst the pandemic? What do you affirm? What brings you joy? What scares you? What do you wish you were seeing? What's it look like to you?
Yeah, you know, I think the pandemic in a lot of ways has really shown a spotlight and exposed a lot of the systemic and deeper issues that were always bubbling there. You know, I almost hate to say bubbling beneath the surface because they're bubbling in a real way for the vast majority of American people. But they were bubbling beneath the surface for, in terms of the attention our politicians and our media give on it. You know, because a lot of the problems that have been exposed are not the problems that politicians in Congress are directly facing. They're not the problems that the people writing our news generally are facing directly. You know, these problems of just a lack of access to basic health care. Wages that have been stagnating for decades, life expectancy going down everywhere. And the pandemic just kind of, it showed a spotlight on it, and it sort of put a bunch of these problems into super drive, you know, and exacerbated them. And the other thing it really showed a spotlight on is the complete lack of ability. You know, it's hard for me to figure out how much of the blame to put on Trump directly versus to put on the system we've created directly, you know, but the lack of ability for anyone at any level of our government and business, you know, to take responsibility, take action, and think it's their job to do something about the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are dying of a deadly virus and our economy is in free fall. There are very obvious things that could have been done and people were proposing to do, you know, at the very beginning of the pandemic. And we saw, you know, we literally got a playbook from countries that got the pandemic before we did, from places like South Korea and Singapore. And we could have just mobilized to enact that playbook and we just completely failed. Instead, it became the worst of politics. It became a battle of finger pointing, you know, Trump trying to take his hands off of it and let the states duke it out and fight with each other for resources, which is just a terrible thing to do. You know, states and towns were literally competing in an open market for PPE for their doctors and nurses. That's the kind of thing that's completely insane if any other country looked at our response for handling a pandemic. And but, you know, it wasn't just Trump. It was also people like Governor Cuomo. You know, New York State was the hardest hit state in the nation and continues to be in one of the states with the highest death rates. And he's trying to claim that he's doing a good job of leading, but he also failed on the job, you know. So it's just a utter lack of failure at all levels of government. And I think, if anything, the thing that I feel positive about this whole crisis is that people are recognizing that big, bold systemic action is necessary, if we're to have any sort of future for this country at all.
I think it's kind of interesting to see what you refer to how dreadful things are for people that the pandemic has unmasked. But I think some of the fault lines were hiding in plain sight for a long time before the, what you might call acute stress, mm-hmm. illuminated the, even further and how we say is reaching our heartstrings and compelling a change of focus or a change of design for our country. And I think your sense of how it's a very fascinating thing to me, because there was a time in recent years where people would say things like, what are you going to do? Like it was a despondency, a resignation. Whereas now it feels like things have become so acute that people feel ashamed of not being active. You see more people out, elderly white people out with Black Lives Matter posters in, you know, the rain or the snow or what have you. And it feels like it's a call to action, and we can't afford to pretend there's nothing we can do about it. And maybe this is going to help vis-a-vis things like climate change as well.
I absolutely agree, you know, and I think that sense of despondency, the disappointment or the disappointing reality of that is even when you talk to our leaders in Congress, you know, I've met many members of Congress and folks who are supposed to be the ones that are actually the ones doing something about it, they feel the same way. That's the really disappointing piece. You know, they also feel like they can't do anything about it. The system is what it is. It's too big to solve. And what you end up seeing often is, you know, so much time gets spent amongst our political leadership focusing on the small problems, because those at least you can do something about. And, you know, that's why we have all these bills renaming post offices that happen. You know, those are like the majority of the bills going through every Congress, and very little effort being put on solving the largest problems. And that's I think it's coming to a head. It's coming to a point where we just can't ignore the largest problems anymore. And in some ways, what the crisis did, what the pandemic did, you know, I actually think if the pandemic had only affected, you know, the bottom 80% of society the way all of these problems so far have, we probably would have continued ignoring the, you know, these problems. But because the pandemics have a way of being affecting everybody in society, it doesn't matter how much money you're making. It's, of course, affecting people in the, you know, the bottom 80, 70% more than it's affecting people in the top 1%. But the top 1% are also getting sick. They're also seeing it. They're also not being able to shop. They're not being able to, you know, go to their restaurants. And so that's brought a sense of urgency to the doorstep of the people who wield real power in our society. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. So you recently wrote a memo with your colleagues that you sent to the transition team and obviously President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris. And it was called Building Back Better with or without Senate Majority. Tell me, there's a lot of anxiety. We're making this recording where, what you might say, the Georgia election and control of Senate is still in front of us. It hasn't been resolved. What is it that, how would I say, gives you confidence that you can do things without having the majority in both houses, given what we experienced during the Obama years?
Yeah, I want to start by saying it's absolutely opens up more avenues and possibilities of the kinds of stuff we can do if we do win the Senate. You know, there's basically more tools in Biden's toolbox if the Democrats have the Senate. But the main point of our memo, you know, step back even further. One of the things that was exciting about Biden's campaign is he actually campaigned on this multi-trillion dollar plan to rebuild the economy, to create millions of high-wage jobs, building the industries of the future. And that includes, of course, you know, the green industries of the future to solve climate change. Because, you know, as it turns out, solving climate change isn't like a cost to solve climate change. It turns out all the new technologies, the new things that are building, electric cars, you know, energy efficient buildings, those are actually the just what an updated economy would be building, because they're cleaner, better, you know, cheaper. Everything about them is just better for people. So if we were just doing normal economic development, that's what we would be doing. But, you know, he's also talking about mobilizing industry and our economy to do things like make our economy pandemic proof, build all kinds of stuff in America to recreate the jobs that have been lost over the past several decades that have led to wages stagnating. And in my mind, when he talked about Build Back Better, literally the vision I have in my head is like, you go to a place like, Janesville, Wisconsin, where there was a GM factory that was pumping out cars, paying people $30, $40, $50 an hour. And that factory disappeared in the 2008 recession and got replaced with minimum wage, $10, $12 an hour jobs. And that's the best that community can get, you know, and that has driven, that is a story all across America. That story has happened in so many places that neighbors have been driven apart, communities have been torn apart, and it's led directly to the kind of political turmoil and disunity that we see right now, the kind of nasty politics that we see right now, because people are suffering and people are hurting. And so I say all that because it's encouraging that Biden campaigned on an actual plan to intentionally go back into a place like Janesville and say, I'm going to build you a factory that's making the electric cars of the future and paying you $50 an hour again, because that's the actual solution to that problem. Now, I give that whole backstory because the big challenge to doing something like this, of course, is where do you get the money to finance that? You know, it's a different question from how do you pay for it. I use the term finance because a lot of what I'm talking about, and a lot of what Biden was talking about building, you know, building electric cars, building electric charging stations, solar panel factories, TVs, batteries, steel, clean steel plants. These are businesses that produce something and make a return. So you don't, it's not like, just an improvement to the social safety net. It's actually building the economy of the future. And you can, and so what we proposed in our plan is, you know, one way to do this, of course, would be to pass a multi-trillion dollar, you know, industry investment plan through Congress and invest directly in those communities that way. But another way to do it is to actually use the incredible power of the Federal Reserve System. And to go back a little bit, basically, you know, the Fed is what was used by both Obama and Bush in the 08 crisis to bail out Wall Street to the tune of about, you know, somewhere between $7 and $29 trillion, you know, so a whole lot of money. And what we're proposing in the plan is basically do the same thing, but this time, you know, instead of just having the Fed bail out Wall Street, let's actually, you know, re-engage the regional federal development banks that are all around the country and empower them to give money directly, you know, in the form of low interest, long-term loans to businesses that are going to be working on these industries that Biden described in Build Back Better. So that's kind of a high level idea is let's use the Fed. You know, Biden should lead because the Fed isn't going to do this on their own. That's one key part. The Fed generally doesn't like to act kind of independently and go, you know, seem political. So they usually like it if Congress gives them, you know, the permission to go do something like this and change their normal mode of operation. And we're saying Biden could absolutely do that by leading and by calling on the Fed to do it, you know, work together with Powell, have his administration do it. And it wouldn't be unusual. It's what our government does in times of crisis over and over again. It's what, you know, as I mentioned, Obama and Bush did with the Fed in 08. It's what, you know, FDR did with the Fed and Mariner Eccles in the 1930s. This is just using the tools, you know, using the Fed as a central bank. One other piece I want to mention real quick is the Federal Reserve System, when it was first put in place, it was actually meant to be kind of a central bank that develops the country. It wasn't meant to just be a banking system that props up Wall Street. It was meant to be something that gives money out to Main Street to help actually develop the economy. And so what our proposal is really talking about is bringing the Fed back to its original roots. Spread the Fed, you know, by letting these regional Feds take control of their regions and develop their local economies, and have Biden lead to give them kind of political space to enact Build Back Better.
In my own reading of your memo, I just want to help our listeners' curiosity. A number of things came across my mind. First, I was fascinated that someone who was associated with Justice Democrats and the development of AOC you had such a constructive tone in relation to this president-elect. It wasn't like those, you know, fights where they say that the thing that a centrist progressive most dislikes are people on the left and vice versa. And, all you know, they leave the right wing alone and get caught in their own fights. But I actually thought you took this very enthusiastically, very constructively, and actually beyond partisan and beyond rivalry, and essentially embraced what you might call a structural economic development vision that everybody should applaud. And that kind of what I would call healing is pretty much what the doctor ordered. It feels to me like the tone you set from your historic vantage point is something that I would encourage people on both sides of the aisle and all parts of the pendulum to emulate.
Yeah. So, you know, Rob, the thing is, I come from a place where I believe you should always present ideas and the benefit of the doubt first, because there's even a tiny, tiny chance that Joe Biden is going to lead a, you know, national development program that improves the lives of millions of people. That's great. I'm going to give him that chance and I will cheer him on if he does it. And I also always believe in removing all excuses for inaction. You know, that was a big goal of that memo, is to show, even if we don't win the Senate, there is no excuse for inaction. You know, Biden absolutely can do everything that he said he wanted to do in the campaign. And the ideas presented in the memo, you're absolutely right, are not partisan ideas. In every country, the basic idea of developing your country's economy is not partisan. That's just what a country does. You know, just to give an example, in America, I mean, first of all of America is an example of this. The entire system of development that so many countries have used to become wealthy all around the world, whether talking about places like South Korea or even China to some extent, you know, we kind of created a lot of foundations of that. I think Frederick List of, you know, German industrial fame, credited Alexander Hamilton for a lot of the ideas he used to industrialize Germany. And currently in America, we do have one example of a state-owned development bank that actually proactively tries to develop its state, and that's in North Dakota. You know, not a bastion of socialists or Democrats or anything. It's a Republican state, North Dakota. They've had a public bank for 100 years. In fact, most of the states in America used to have a public bank, but most of them are gone now. North Dakota's the last one. And it turns out, you know, North Dakota was the state that I think did the best per capita in terms of receiving PPP loans, because they had their central bank manage the whole operation of getting those loans to local businesses. And they're the only state, when I checked at least a couple months ago, that had net increase in employment during the pandemic, because they had sort of planned for this kind of a downturn, because they had looked ahead a little bit. When times were going well, they saved and tried to diversify their economy. And now the times are tough, they're using their savings to try to keep people from going under. And that was the same story in the 08 recession. North Dakota did remarkably well through the 08 recession. So, you know, just the basic idea of building a resilient economy where the people at the bottom of the economy are still doing well and are actively trying to improve everyone's lives is not a partisan issue at all. This is just basic what you do as a country, or you fall behind and become a poorer country overall.
And do you feel like, how would I say, you talked about the resistances that, in other words, people can sense the need to do something, like you talked about the wake-up call of the pandemic. But these, how would I say, the pathways through which things were achieved. We always relied on monetary policy because we said fiscal policy was too messy. You couldn't do things in the short term or what have you. And when I read your memo, you kind of broke it into what was the task, then how would I say, I think you called instrumentalities, yes, I'm sorry. And then, in other words, the different institutional structures and innovations or redeployment of existing institutions, and then what would be the benefits. And what I felt like you did a beautiful job of is that you were showing the analogies, particularly vis-a-vis the central bank, of how it's behaved historically exactly, not in identical consequences, but analogous, similar consequences, and how with the, what you might call slight adjustment, you said this in the introduction, of moving away from funding the financial sector in order to fund the recovery to going directly to the real economy, which is more like a fiscal policy than a monetary policy. And but I sensed that you were very, effective in saying, even without a change in the Senate, you've got things you can do that look just like things that the Fed has done, or the so-called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, or national development banks. And with a little change, a little courage, and a little change of habits, these things are not unfeasible.
Yeah, we're also saying that the things we're proposing here, it's not just stuff that we did in the past. It's stuff that most developed countries around the world do right now. You know, it's not I like to give this example often of the iPhone. You know, all the parts in the iPhone got built sort of through research that was federally funded, largely by American taxpayer dollars, but also by the governments of a few other countries. And then there, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple, which was a great company, managed to figure out how to put those pieces together into this small device that we call the iPhone that's changed so many people's lives. But then when it came time to actually build the iPhone, you know, and reap kind of the benefits of this stuff that kind of got invented in America, the places that got the contracts to build parts of the iPhone, of course, we all know about China, but actually more than half the value of the iPhone is built in high-wage industrialized countries like Germany, Switzerland, South Korea, all places that also have, you know, central banks that plan their economic development. They look forward to the next technological leap, they invest in it, and then they try to proactively make sure that they're building some of it to create wealth for their nation. That's just a basic thing countries do, you know? And so, you know, when we're proposing this whole idea of what Biden should do, you know, you mentioned the resistances, right? And I think you kind of nailed it on the head that fiscal policy is something that's fallen out of favor because it's hard. You know, the real resistance of doing something like what we're talking about is that it seems big, but you know what? We got a big problem. Climate change is a big problem. Our country and an economic depression is a big problem. And the current sort of approach, the hands-off approach we have to these problems, which is, you know, sort of this faith in another power to come in and solve it for us, isn't going to work. You know, so we either have to roll up our sleeves and decide to tackle the big problems, or we're going to, you know, we're just kind of accepting the long suffering, grueling demise of America, and we're saying we're okay managing that decline.
And do you, how would I say, when you're exploring this, I'm sure you've been out and about, I know you've written in The Nation and Politico, been interviewed in various places. What kind of blowback do you get? What kind of resistance do you get from financiers?
You know, The main kind of resistance I think I would get, because honestly, the folks I've talked to in the news so far, they usually come away from this sort of surprise, because whenever you tell anyone that actually we can do everything we want to do, there's nothing stopping us. And the only things really stopping us are political will and kind of, you know, political norms that we've set up for not doing these things. They find that surprising, you know, and they're like, well, why aren't we just doing it? But I'd say the real pushback from kind of non-journalists and people who are more traditionally in economics is they just don't think that that's what the government should do. It's just like this fundamental value that they have. I don't know if you read Reed Hunt's book, you know, about kind of, I think his book is called Crisis Wasted. I think I'm not mixing up titles, but he has this anecdote in that book.
Yeah.
About,
yeah, I read the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's this great anecdote in that book about how, you know, after the recession, Joe Biden actually and Barack Obama both kind of proposed, you know, building something concrete. You know, Obama, I think, famously said when he saw the, you know, Larry Summers' plan for the bailout and everything, he said, where's the Hoover Dam? You know, because, you know, where's like the the actual thing we're building to create jobs. And their instincts were 100% right. But the unfortunate thing was they were being advised by people like Larry Summers, whose response to that was, well, that's not what the government does, you know? And so it's just this basic, fundamental, wrong-headed kind of ideology, actually. I think of it as like these ideologically strict people who haven't been able to become flexible to a different time, who are ideologically opposed to the government doing anything. And the government, especially to the government building things or investing in industry and developing the economy intentionally. And I think that's just an old conservative ideology that the time for which is gone. You know, that's in the past. And now we got to look forward and actually look towards, we can't think of ourselves. This whole idea of either a developing country or developed country is, I think, sort of at the crux of this. You know, you shouldn't become a developed country that stops developing. The moment you stop developing is the moment you start dying. And we should go back to the mindset of being a developing nation, because we should constantly be developing our nation and constantly be trying to create the jobs and the industries of the future that will give people the means of making a living in this country.
Well, I think that notion of, you know, that's just not what we do. There's a leftist blogger, I think his name is Ian Welsh, who basically says, well, after 2008, all of the bailouts and everything of the financial sector without real consequences essentially destroyed the discipline of capitalism. I think he calls it the mother of all moral hazards. And what he was essentially saying is, if you're going to adhere to that market discipline, then you have to let financial institutions pay the price for their misdeeds. And they hadn't. Now, I know there are others who would say their misdeeds have what economists call negative externalities, and they can take us all down with the ship and we all drown. And that's none of us should pay that much of that price. Probably more supervision, more capital buffers required of financial institutions, things like that, would have, diminished the likelihood. But I see is this, it's right on the edge of what I might call wild-eyed corruption, which is, if you think you can do whatever you want because you can control the government and get yourself subsidized ex post, what I call access to contingent fiscal capacity, then there is no discipline. On the other hand, as you pointed out so artfully in your essays and in your memo, we're already doing these kinds of things. And I go back to a man who I worked with around the time of the beginning of the savings and loan bailout, the investment banker Felix Rawton. He's no longer with us, but I used to talk with him quite a lot. And he wrote a book called Bold Endeavors, How Government Built America and Why We Must Rebuild It Now. And that came to my mind as I was reading your articles and your memo, that in essence, it's kind of a false consciousness to think we ever had that market system and what you might call those moral win-or-lose boundaries that people of a more conservative orientation wish we could achieve.
Yeah, I would agree, you know, I got to read that book. I haven't read that. But the way I sort of see often how markets work, and this isn't 100%, you know, this is a little bit simplifying the course of things, but it's often the case that the government creates the space and the ecosystems for the new market to flourish. You know, the government guides and directs and creates the place for a market to flourish. And we've seen this in the major industries of our country. I mean, look at Silicon Valley, right? Like all the initial technology and investment came from the government and semiconductor research. And so, you know, government research invested and created the foundations of Silicon Valley. It wasn't just research, though. It was also government, you know, one of the first piece of financing Apple got as a company was a small business loan from the government, right? Mm-hmm. And so what my take on the 08 recession, you know, and the 08 crash was it actually, you know, in that moment, I agree. I don't think we should have let all the banks fail because it would have taken everyone down with it. But that was a half solution. That was, you know, maybe even a third solution. And we only did that part of the solution because Wall Street was in the ear of the administration saying, this is the, you know, that's the most urgent thing. That's what we got to do. But then we didn't do the other side of the solution, which was, you know, also making sure to put in money to save our small businesses and the economy elsewhere, and also putting in money to keep the mortgage holders from going under and keep the American people from suffering. Because if you look at it, you know, the recovery after recession for most Americans, you know, it was at least 10 years, if that, you know, many people never recovered. And so that's the kind of thing that I worry about. We're seeing it again now in response to COVID. You know, so much of our congressional action has been so tilted towards just saving, like, you know, the Boeings of the world. And almost nothing has gone towards saving the people and the small businesses of the world. And I'm not saying we necessarily need to, you know, make Boeing suffer. I'm saying let's do the whole damn thing. You know, let's actually develop the entire economy. Don't just do these Band-Aid solutions to keep our, you know, kind of inefficient and poorly functioning financial system going. Let's do the actual productive stuff, and let's actually build those new ecosystems for that would be incredibly pro-business ecosystems, like, you know, Janesville and Detroit for building cars, and Silicon Valley for building, you know, software technology, and, you know, Wichita, Kansas for building airplane parts. That's the kind of stuff we should be focusing on doing for all the new things that we know we need to build, like electric cars and machines to build electric cars and solar panels and batteries and everything else that goes along with that.
I think, how would I say, that has an optimistic air. There's kind of a bootstrap that people think they can get a job, get paid a little more. What was the book when we were talking before this, Janesville, that you talked about?
Yeah.
Was it people in Wisconsin who used to get $40 to $50 and now they get $10 to $12. But the idea of higher value added, even physical work, not just mental knowledge intensive work, bringing that back to life, modernizing our transportation systems. I have a friend who works at the IMF. He's from China. And he comes up to see me in New York and he's always just shaking his head after he rides the Amtrak train. Like, why do you guys have these trains that go one third of the speed of the ones in China? And so there, I think there's not only the structural benefits from the changes, there's the employment benefits, but there's a sense of pride that you're getting back, what you might call, to having a cutting edge society and infrastructure. And also, I think that the people who wanted everything to be what just, you know, what markets do or governments do, I don't think we should underestimate the relative importance of public goods rather relative to private commodities in our society in terms of the, which you might call, platforms of well-being, and the way, which I remember reading in one of your offerings, the way in which having more vigorous public goods improves the rate of return for private investment and creates a more vigorous, what you might call, bootstrap of private investment, because it's planting its feet in the context of a more efficient and potentially more profitable system.
Yeah, it's you know, the whole debate about the government's role versus the private industry's role, it just misses the point, because there isn't some structural silver bullet that'll fix everybody's life. You know, there isn't some answer of like, okay, if the government does 30% of the job and we give 70% of the economy to the private industry, then everything works out. No, that's just never going to work that way. It's never how it's ever worked. And that's never how any country got any, you know, modern developed nation, as we would call them, got there. The way we get there is through actually figuring out problem by problem how to solve it together as a society, whether that's, you know, public, you know, the government working together with private industry, or sometimes it's maybe the government doing its own thing and investing in public goods, because there are many, many things that should just be services, and, you know, things like infrastructure should just be a service that exists. And I remember reading something about how the highway system, for example, has basically returned $6 for every dollar spent back into the economy, because it was incredibly good public money spent. But also things like paid family leave, you know, it's a huge it's a moral hazard, of course, or not moral hazard, it's a moral atrocity that we don't allow new mothers and fathers to spend any time with their children. But it's also terrible for our economy because you're basically creating the situation where people who have to, you know, they have to figure out a way to pay for childcare or bring their kids or not be able to work because they had a kid and then they lose money and go into poverty. It's just a bad idea on every front to not have paid family leave. And so there's a lot that the government can do and should do just in terms of basic social safety net stuff that where America is very far behind. And then there's a lot that America can do in terms of investing in infrastructure and creating public goods. But then separately, the thing that we're really talking a lot about in this plan is there's a lot the government can do in working together with private industry to build the new industries. You know, and that's a piece that I think hasn't been a big focus in our politics, at least recently. One of the pieces I kind of wanted to quickly mention, Rob, just because it's, you know, a little bit of an inspiration for me and all this kind of work that I do is just this idea that, you know, when my father came to this country back in the 1970s, you know, that was like during the era when we were building the interstate highway system and we were growing so fast that we were demanding immigrants to come to this country. You know, we were recruiting immigrants. My dad actually got recruited at an immigration recruitment center in India to come to this country. And he was able to, you know, walk around with a resume and get a job in his first day as an engineer in New York. And there was just this environment that was so positive and, you know, felt like, of course, you know, there are entire parts of society that are being left out and we didn't have everything right, but it felt like the direction was going in the right direction, that the direction was forward and that we had something to look forward to. And that's really the, you know, when I think of like what Biden could do through a plan like this, that's sort of the image I have in my head is, can he create this country where everyone's feeling positive, even if we're not getting the returns, you know, immediately? You know, not everyone's not going to come out of poverty on day one, but at least it feels like there's some hope for the future.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, which is what I will say the place that America divorced after the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act. And when the downturn came in the auto industry, created a consciousness that the American dream, which Detroit had personified, was evaporating both violently and rapidly. And as a result, there was a lot of public relations, so not with coming to their assistance, but to blaming the victims as though it was some character flaw. Mm-hmm. Black public administration, entrepreneurs are fat cats. Now they lost their mojo, all that kind of stuff. And I watched the disintegration of the Detroit area, and I often see that experience as kind of a window into what's happened in the aftermath era of globalization, automation, austere state and local budgets. It's almost as if the divorce of Detroit was an early warning indicator for the deterioration of society. I do some philanthropic work now, and I was curious because I know you used to work in the Silicon Valley world prior to your entrance into public policy and politics. And I've often thought that internet infrastructure, particularly now with so much remote schooling in light of the pandemic, should be a public good and provided at a performance threshold to the United States of America. I think of it for several reasons. I've seen a lot of internet companies start up and migrate toward the places where the population was dense, provide quality internet there, which inspired more people to migrate to that area. And so there was kind of a amplifying feedback loop, which had negative consequences in places like Western Massachusetts. But I also feel as though, I mean, in Detroit itself, which is a reasonably, it's not quite 1 million people now, but there's a lot of population there. There's a study that I read that the internet infrastructure measured by performance of the top 275 cities, Detroit finishes 254th. And I started thinking about, with the importance related to education, remote education, and so forth, we're not just harming those people in a one shot. When those people don't get the access and the training and the ability to satisfy their curiosity, become lifelong learners, they're probably more difficult to manage, how would I say, socially, transitions and welfare payments, et cetera, as opposed to versatile and new jobs. And it weakens democracy to have citizens who are, I'll call it, not well-trained to think about public issues. And so I feel as though just leaving it up to the private sector to set up the internet infrastructure, I'm not talking about not, contracting people for providing services and installation and all that kind of stuff. But doesn't there need to be a national standard of internet quality on every square inch of our 50 states and Puerto Rico and beyond?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, universal broadband is one of those issues where there should be broad-based consensus. You know, it's not a left or a right thing. It's just, you know, in fact, it would probably most improve the lives, as you kind of referenced, in rural areas, which tend to vote Republican. So, you know, and there are Republicans who are for, you know, expanding broadband, but that's actually one of the issues I found in Congress that's most defined by the opposition is entirely money, because the utility companies or the internet companies in a lot of these areas are, you know, they have these strong monopolies. And they play hardball. They try to make sure, even when cities try to do municipal broadband, that they are not able to do it. You know, they make their lives very difficult. And it's the kind of thing where the federal government is like the entity that has a big enough hammer and enough of a presence to fight against that and make it happen. There's no reason internet should not be a universal public good. You know, for a lot of things where people say, this should be a right. Sometimes there's like an actual, you know, it's difficult to build it out. It's difficult. We don't have the resources to do it or whatever, but internet, we absolutely could. It'd be a drop in the bucket of the federal budget to create universal broadband. And there's no, you know, obvious left versus right divide. There's actually a lot of stuff like that, which aren't partisan issues. There's no reason to be partisan. They're just the obvious solution to an obvious problem. But one of the problems of our kind of political system right now is that everything gets framed in this left versus right, you know, diagram, and the media likes to talk about it that way. And then you got to start talking about, well, is universal broadband a left issue or a right issue? So what's the moderate compromise? And it's such a harmful way to talk about anything, because this is just, as you mentioned, it's just the answer to a whole host of problems. What's the, you know, why are we in search of a worse answer if we already have a good one?
Yeah. Well, you talked about that notion of what I'll call rent seeking or rent protecting by existing companies that would be averse to transition. We see that in the fossil fuel industry related to climate change. Buying more time and keeping us reliant on oil works for them. But if we play too much into their hands, we could extinguish life on Earth. But I look at the situation, and what hurts me, and I've worked in both Republican and Democratic parties during my career, is to see people on both sides of the aisle becoming despondent about the potential for government to be effective, because they see all this monkey business and the rent seeking and what I'll call the legalized corruption. They see the commodification of social design. And what I mean by that is laws, regulations, enforcement, who gets appointed, and how that interrelates with enforcement. And so you have this refraction of social design in a way that's very, very harmful to the faith, the trust in governance, expertise, whatever you want to call it. And I think the financial crisis of 2008 and the bailouts thereafter, accelerated that loss of trust. And so this is like we talked about at the outset, a call to action, a very interesting time where I talk about pharmaceutical policies on one day, and we talk about the financial sector on another day, and the fossil fuel industry and climate on another. But I'm starting to ask myself, do we not need to change the incentive system and make votes more powerful and money less powerful in order to be able to do dynamic, high-quality public policy from here to the distant future?
Yeah, the government is, at the end of the day, the people that get elected into government, right? You know, it's not this separate thing. I think people, the government is us. The government should be us. And so people get despondent because they see so many problems in the current system. And there's sort of two roads you go down there, you know, when you get despondent. Like, either you can choose to just give up on government, which I think means you give up on society. You know, then you're giving up on doing anything, and you're kind of retreating to your into your bubble and just waiting it out. Or you can try to fix it. And I think that's the only answer. The only answer is to fix it. And money in politics, especially in the levels of money that are in American politics, have totally distorted, who the current people who are in office, not all of them, but who many of the current people who are in office and the major leaders of the party listen to. It's not always outright corruption. It's not always quid pro quo, I'm going to give you some money and you vote this way. I've seen that happen as well, for what it's worth, but it's not the majority of it. The major problem is the culture it's created. Who are the people writing our bills, you know, listening to? Because a lot of these Congress people, they don't have enough staff to write their own bills. So they outsource that work, lobbyists. And to them, you know, they justify to themselves as these lobbyists. You know, they used to work in this industry, so they're the experts on it. But of course, they, you know, those lobbyists are also working for those industries, and they have very entrenched interests to promote their industries. And so that's why you end up with the Wall Street bailout. You know, I mean, that's why in the first place you end up with the people who were advising President Obama, you know, which was basically off of a list that Citigroup made for him. And it was all Wall Street people. When the recession was happening, every single person advising Obama about what to do with the economy was from Wall Street. There was nobody in there from industry, even no one from labor, no one from all the, you know, the 90% of the economy that was about to go under. Wall Street is not the economy, right? But that's what this system of money and politics creates. Like, those are the people in the room. Those are the people who are creating pressure on you. And those are people that you end up, as a political leader, responding to first. And therefore, you end up bailing out the banks and ignoring the rest of the work, you know, or at least making the bailout of the banks a number one priority, and then failing to get the rest of the work done. So it's a deep problem, but such a chicken and egg, because how do you get rid of the money in politics without first electing officials who don't rely on that money in politics, right? And so that's, you know, that's ultimately was, you know, the original goal and drive of Justice Democrats, which is a group that I helped start. And, you know, we elected Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and there's now 10 Justice Democrats in Congress. And I think that work's incredibly important to get us to a more sustainable solution. A lot of the stuff I'm talking about here are things that Biden can do right now to get us out of the current economic crisis. But alongside that, we need to actually change the political systems that have enabled us to get to this level of stagnation that we currently have.
Yeah, I mean, along with active tactics like voter suppression, there is a sense in which the despondency that arises from feeling not represented by your representative because they've turned their head towards money also encourages what you might call apathy or distancing or lower turnout. And I think reversing that is very important. When I've talked to people in this last couple of days of preparation who've read your memos and so forth, the people who I used as my test platform who were conservatives were, I mean, the people who said, oh, that's kind of romantic, you know, et cetera, et cetera. The National Development Council and the central bank and stuff, that's all part of the corrupt system. And so some of the ones that adhere to the pure free market system, which I think is a misspecification of social needs, are doing so because they don't trust government institutions, however nobly envisioned, to be able to execute on behalf of the people. there was a man named Stuart Zechman, who's a musician, during the Obama years. And in around 2011, some Obama official came out on Politico, unnamed, maintained anonymity, and said, you can't do the things like Franklin Roosevelt used to do because nobody believes in government. And Zechman went to the Gallup polls, and he came onto a podcast, which I'm happy to share with you, and said, the Gallup polls say the reason people on the progressive side don't trust the government is they think it's captured. So what you might call uncapturing the government not only changes the policies, but changes the enthusiasm and perhaps turnout and participation and strengthens democracy at the same time. And so I tend to think where you went is the right design for what society needs. And then we have to re-engender the trust and the enthusiasm. And the only way that'll be done is if people realize that they're better off because of the kind of things that you've requested. Let me shift focus here as we're coming down the stretch. You talked about the task a little bit, and you talked a little bit about central banking, but the instrumentalities, what kind of institutions, innovative or modified institutions, do you think we need to rely on to bring about this development transformation of America?
Yeah, so in the memo, we kind of have four major pillars, major instrumentalities we talk about. One is this idea of a National Development Council, which is something that Joe Biden can set up within the executive branch. You know, the idea would be to be staffed with, it'd be a kind of a cross-agency group whose job would be to create the national economic strategy sort of based off of Build Back Better. Because Build Back Better is a good campaign plan, but it's not an actual, you know, economic development plan that can be executed. So their job would be to create that plan. And it would be, you know, in the memo we say, you know, perhaps it's the Secretary of Commerce, Secretary of Labor, you know, the Treasury Secretary, and maybe some members from Congress, like a Speaker and Majority Leader, are part of this kind of council to put this thing together. And there would be a council that, you know, if it has members from Congress, therefore is democratically accountable as well. And so that plan that they develop would sort of form a blueprint for the Federal Reserve to use. And one of the things we'd say in the memo is we should spread the Fed. This is what I was referring to earlier as being, you know, essentially taking the current Federal Reserve system where mostly it's become centralized in New York, and instead allowing the other 12 regional federal development banks to be empowered to give out loans and develop their local region. So you have the Dallas Fed focus on the Southwest again, instead of you know, New York trying to figure out who should be, you know, what business should be getting money in Dallas, Texas, or in Phoenix, Arizona. And so the Fed would start mobilizing this plan by giving money out to businesses and to local development projects based off of the Build Back Better plan. At the same time, another financing arm for this whole plan would be a national development bank that we propose creating within the Treasury using money that's already allocated to the Treasury. There's already the FFB, which is I believe is a federal financing bank within the Treasury that does some amount of projects. But these, we kind of imagine the National Development Bank would take on some of the more public intensive projects. So things like, you know, building the charging network, which could be a large infrastructure project that could be financed through the National Development Bank. And the final piece, which I didn't even talk about in this interview, but I think is a major component of this, is the idea of creating digital taxpayer wallets. So the Treasury actually already has the ability for us to create digital taxpayer wallets. They have a digital platform where anyone can go and create a Treasury account. And we're basically proposing, you know, creating one for everyone in America solves this huge problem of bringing millions of people who currently are unbanked, you know, so they have no way to currently cash checks or do any of the normal banking operations. That's why loan sharks have this massive industry in America, giving them all a federal bank account, right? But the other piece it solves is whenever we've got to do things like, you know, give people a $600 stimulus check or do some, you know, keep people afloat while a pandemic is happening, we'd have a direct way to give people money that isn't a huge complicated mess that we currently have, and we'd be able to do it immediately. It also would be a way, this gets a little bit more in the weeds, for us to, you know, combat inflationary pressure more directly instead of just, you know, lowering or decreasing interest rates on banks and hoping those interest rates filter down to people. We could increase interest rates on digital taxpayer wallets and incentivize people to save, and that would combat any inflationary pressure from the larger industrial project that we're taking on. So I think that those are sort of the four main ideas. You know, the bulk of the financing in this whole thing is coming out of the Fed, which is why I spent a lot of time talking about that. But the National Development Council is sort of, you can think of it as the plan making arm. The National Development Bank is kind of the government's banking arm. The Fed is sort of the more private banking arm. And then the digital taxpayer wallets is kind of straight to the people, direct money piece of it.
So I think that, how you say, that's interesting. I imagine, as I was listening to a banking lobby resisting something so direct, because it sort of cuts out all their exorbitant fees. Every time you go to an ATM and you get $100 and you pay a $2 fee, that's more than the interest you earn for a whole year on that $100. And so that would be a much more, how would I say, potentially efficient for the consumer. But I would imagine the rent seekers would descend upon that pretty aggressively.
Yeah, you know,
but I think it's a beautiful idea. I like the idea.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
There's two kinds of entrenched industries that sometimes oppose progress in our country, and I think the fossil fuel companies versus kind of the banks is a good example. There's some industries that are actually, they're providing something. Fossil fuel companies, whatever you think of them, you know, they are building the energy systems that we currently rely on. And I think the way you approach them, because there's tons of people employed in fossil fuel companies, is you actually have to figure out a way to transition them out and give those employees jobs and create the new energy future before you get rid of fossil fuel companies. You can't just, you know, get rid of all fossil fuel companies and hope that the electric economy gets built. You got to do that proactively. But then there's this other piece, which I think is almost entirely just predatory and just sucks money out of our economy. And that's the rent seekers, as you're calling them. You know, that's the people just charging, money to transfer money, the loan sharks, the health insurance companies. They're not adding any value to the economy. They're just taking what everyone else is making. And I have no problem putting those people out of business.
Yeah. That's, how would I say, eliminating local monopolies and predators. It reminded me, growing up in Detroit, my dad worked downtown. He had an urban medical practice. And whenever I went into a grocery store with him downtown to pick up something on the way home, I was always in shock because the prices were about 30% higher than they were in the suburbs.
Right.
And because people didn't have access to transportation in the urban areas, they were captured. And they, without the mobility, there wasn't as much competition. I think in the payday lending world, it becomes more ominous than that by a considerable amount. But I like the notion that you've brought forward with the digital wallets. And as we come down, what is it that you think the consequences are? You've talked about institutions transforming industry, etc. Do you feel that that we can, in a 4 or 6 year time frame, regain a lot of confidence and momentum, and what I will call heal the despondency that has gripped our society?
You know, I don't think we can fully solve all the major problems that we've created for ourselves in 4 years. I don't think we can. It's quite a bit. I mean, especially when we bring in something like climate change, you know, it will be a lot of work to completely change the energy systems that our entire economy is dependent on right now in 4 years. So a lot of the goal in the first 4 years, and especially in the first 2 years of Biden's presidency, is going to be to show that this stuff can work. You know, you said that people have lost faith in government. Well, they've lost faith in government to some extent because of the corruption. But to a larger extent, I'd say, is because they haven't actually seen government work and create and build a new stuff. My generation, you know, our experience with government has been the 08 recession, going into the Iraq war, right? Just kind of misstep after misstep. And we didn't have an Apollo program. We didn't have a New Deal. We didn't have a, you know, mobilization to, you know, defeat the Nazis. We never saw the other side of this, of what could be possible with this power. And so if Biden can, in his first 2 years, enact the parts of his Build Back Better program that create the most amount of high-wage jobs in as many of the places as possible, that's going to be very key. You know, he can't just make a bunch of high-wage jobs in New York City and San Francisco and in Chicago. He's got to do something. You know, I love his building retrofitting program, because that's so every congressional district has a building. So create high-wage jobs, retrofitting buildings, you know, insulating them, putting solar panels on in every district. And if he can create millions of jobs that way, I think he can get he can actually show that we're capable of doing something. And I think Democrats would then get rewarded with a political majority in the midterms. You know, there's no president other than FDR in 1934 and Bush right after 9/11 has won both the House and the Senate after their first midterm election. And I think the way you do that is the FDR way, is you show FDR didn't do the whole New Deal in 2 years, but he got enough of a start that people knew he was acting, he was doing, and he was having some success. And so it's worth giving them a shot to keep it going.
Yeah. Well, I remember years ago, there was a young woman from China that worked with me at INET, and her father worked in a cell phone company in Shenzhen, and he went to the Consumer Electronics Las Vegas meeting, I think it's called CES, and was coming to New York, and I'd met him several times, he asked if he could meet with me. So he took me out to lunch, and the purpose of the meeting was that he thought that Joe Biden had underestimated the Chinese, because he had gone to Shenzhen and spoke at a meeting where he said, the really great phones are all going to be made by Apple in the United States, but that's going to help your society, etc. And his company had created a phone that had 3D graphics, so you could watch a movie in 3D on the phone. And this gentleman from China asked me to go give it to Joe Biden to say, we never would have been inspired to create that phone if you hadn't told us we couldn't. So what I was thinking about as I was reading your report, and you come down to the end about and you talk about the transformation and the change in the bicycle, is that I'm tempted personally to go back to Joe Biden and buy him a Peloton cutting edge training bicycle if he executes your report. I think, he inspired the Chinese to make a better phone. If he makes a better country, I'll get him a better bike.
I'll join in with that, with you on that.
Yeah, that'd be the cheapest incentive you and I ever created. We'd be accused of being lobbyists, but lobbyists for the public good. I'll stand with that. But anyway, thank you very much. Any final thoughts? Anything you want to impart before we adjourn?
No, I mean, you know, the only thing I'd say is it's easy, I think, especially after the last 4 years, to feel pessimistic and to feel like everything is lost. But I really do think that we could have the brightest days ahead of us if we choose to do it. And it's just, you know, everything, this whole interview, you know, we got into Fed policy and all this complicated stuff. But at the end of the day, the only thing that all this boils down to is, do our political leaders and us, because we're the ones who are going to have to pressure them to find their courage and find their bravery, do we have what it takes to just take a step forward and do what needs to be done?
Yes. Well, I understand from our past conversations that you recently became a father.
That's right. Yeah.
So what I would offer to you as a father of four children is that we don't have the option to be despondent. We gotta pass the baton to them, and despondency is a capitulation to failing in that mission. So I think you're right in concluding there is no basis for despondency, and with the kind of vision that you've created, And with the kind of energy you've brought to bear and the encouragement of the administration, you're setting an excellent example for the way I hope we all can, how we say, rise to the challenge and behave. Thanks for being with me. Let's turn the corner, get into next year, see how it's playing out. Maybe at that point we could join back together for another session and give it a, how do I say, 100-day review, something like that.
That sounds excellent. Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye. And check out more from the Institute for New Economic Thinking at ineteconomics.org.
And I'll tell it and speak it and think it and breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start singing.